So again, welcome for anyone whom I haven't met. My name is Donald Rothberg, and I share the teaching on these most of the Wednesdays with Sylvia Borstein, who will be here next week, and then I'll be back for, I plan is 3 weeks in a row. And let me invite anyone who is here to the Wednesday gathering for the first time. If you could just raise your hand, say your name and where you live, and we want to welcome you, please.
My name is Max.
Yeah, welcome, Max.
Hey, I'm Bill.
Yeah, welcome, Bill. Yeah, welcome. And your name?
Helen.
Welcome, Helen. Yeah, please.
Edmund from Oakland.
Yeah, welcome, Edmund. Please.
Barbara from Petaluma.
Yeah, welcome, Barbara. Yeah. Yeah, welcome, Kay. Yeah, so we'll have a few announcements now. There'll be about 7 or 8 minute time to use bathrooms or connect with other people. I think today something I sometimes do is I also use that time for people who want to ask any questions, any kind of questions about practice. I'll stay here during that time and see if there are any questions or reflections. And then we come back, we'll come try to come back a little bit before 11, and then there'll be a talk, and typically there's a talk and discussion. Sometimes we have groups and so forth, but that's the usual. We finish about noon, sometimes a little bit after, but just around noon. So let's see, my announcements. I'm teaching on Saturday in this building, a day long, with my friend Marisa Handler. It's called Through the Dark Night. It's on the theme of the so-called Dark Night of the Soul, which some of you may know if you went to Catholic school, because it's a term from St. John of the Cross, a Catholic mystic from like the 16th century. And it'll be a whole day on that here, I think 10 to 5, and we'll bring out that theme. It's really about sometimes protracted, challenging periods in one's life, which are actually opportunities for learning and growth. And for St. John of the Cross, the dark night of the soul was actually something that did not occur to people near the beginning of the spiritual path, but more in the middle or advanced stages. And it was an opportunity actually to go more deeply and go past some of the more conventional types of spirituality. So there'll be the day long. We'll have have some short talks and quite a lot of chance for sharing. I think there'll probably be a lot of people sharing experiences. We'll talk about the challenges of such periods, as well as what helps. And as well, though, I think, you know, they should have a good number of people. I think we have close to 50 people, which is probably could be, could be quite a bit more. So it should be a nice group. And then I think upcoming events, let's see, I have some flyers out on the table with my teaching schedule, as well as the book I usually bring, last book I've done, which is called The Engaged Spiritual Life, on connecting inner work with bringing one's inner work into social service and social change work. So that's out on the table. And there's a flyer for a non-residential retreat in Berkeley on skillful speech, which will be at the end of April, the last week in April, 6 day, like 9 to 5. It's a really great format because you get to train from 9 to 5 every day and then go home and see how you're doing. So it's fun. And then some other retreats, I think in May and June, I teach a retreat here, a more advanced retreat called Settling, Seeing, and Spacious Awareness. And then in June, I'm part of a retreat on, it's called Aging, Dying, and Awakening, which, again, I'm a little critical of the order of the words in the title, but anyway, it's what it is. Okay, so other announcements, please. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Beth.
Can you project?
Hi.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much. Good. So let's come back, and it's about, according to this clock, about a little, let's come back just a little bit before 11. So it'd be come back in about 7 or 8 minutes, and I'll ring some bells. And I will stay here and just take any questions of any kind about one's practice as well, if people want to stay. So you can go ahead and ask now if you have anything. Yeah.
What is
Question is, what is my definition of skillful speech? We work with quite a lot of tools. You know, in 6 days, there's a lot of material. But there's a traditional definition that comes from the Buddha. Because the term would be translated as right speech or wise speech. And there are 4 criteria for that kind of speech. One is to be truthful. And they all have to go together. You can't just have one of them. To be truthful, to be helpful, to come out of a kind heart, which can coexist with being really firm, saying no, etc. Coming out of a kind heart and having good timing. So we expand on those, but that's part of what we teach in the retreat. But it's, you know, we expand, we make it practical in a lot of ways. You use a lot of different tools. We actually integrate the discipline of nonviolent communication under the rubric of mindfulness.
Well, do you go into each of the...
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's a lot of practical things. The first two-thirds of the retreat are establishing foundations and really practicing the foundations of skillful speech. And then the last part is bringing those foundational capacities to difficult situations. So we do role play. You can have someone role play your partner or your difficult roommate or whatever. And you get to try out, how do you bring skillful speech to the difficult situations? It's a lot of fun, you know. Yeah, no, it's really...
I'm taking classes in speech, too.
Yeah.
Which would be huge.
Yeah.
What's going on with defining...
Yeah. It's a big area. Yeah, we figure we have about 30 hours of material. And that's just the foundations.
Could you focus on trust? How to train?
Well, we will take any questions. If that comes up, we'll work with that. Yeah.
I'm kidding there.
No, it comes up.
My inner desires.
No, it's really an example of working. How do you speak with someone who triggers you? Right? How do you do that? So it's, you know, for some it could be a more extreme version of, you know, just what you do with people around you. You know, for some it'd be less extreme, but for many people it's triggering. And the basic principle is that you train where things are not too hard. And you work up to the harder ones. That's our training principle. That's a basic training principle in many fields, right? Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Any other questions? This is kind of an experiment just to see if this works. Yeah, please.
I have a question about the Buddhist training.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
When you breathe a long breath, you know you're...
Oh, yeah. This is from the text, yeah.
Right. And
yeah.
Then there's the next one, which is... Not just
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what your take is on
it. Yeah. That's a good question. So it's a question really about how we understand the breath. And I'll try to track time so I don't get so caught up in the question that I lose track. So yeah, and it's in reference to the core text on the training of mindfulness, which is the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the usually translated as the discourse on the foundations or the establishments of mindfulness. And it's a great question because there is a kind of way that people at teachers at Spirit Rock and also at associated centers like Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts teach, which isn't completely lined up with what you find in the text. And there's also the text, the Anapanasati Sutta, which is a different text. But we generally give instructions similar to what I gave earlier. That is, we invite people to see where the breath is easiest to follow and stay with that at the level of sensation. And for some, it is an option to be with the breath and the whole body. For others, we say, be at the nostrils or be at the chest or be at the belly. So we generally give, those are the four main options we give. So we give options for people to see what works best for them. And that is, you know, that's different than just really clearly following what you find in that text. You know, we don't pay so much attention to know when it's a long breath. We don't do that. We pay a lot of attention to stay with the qualities of the breath, stay and be with it. I'm going to ring the bell now, but I can keep on with the discussion. So if we can call people in from the outside, that would be helpful. Yeah. So. Yeah. 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 I think we don't follow the words strictly. But I find myself often, like when I teach Qigong as a wonderful, and for people in this society, it's actually extremely helpful to calm the body before trying meditation. Because if the body's not calm, it just translates into like that, right? And so even 5 minutes of yoga can be really helpful before meditating. Something like, you know, 10, 20 minutes of Qigong, even just take a walk. So some way of calming the body is very helpful. Yeah?
I just wanted to say the lady in the back had the baby, was kind of raising her hand. It's her first time.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, she didn't speak up.
Oh, okay.
She kind of, mothers get left out sometimes.
Oh, did you want to, why don't we invite her to would you like to, would you like to just say your name and is this your first time?
Yeah, this is my first
time. Oh, great. Welcome. Yeah. So great, great you can come with your little one and early training. How are we doing? Are there still people out in the foyer? Why don't we, could someone again close the back doors? That'd be helpful. Or if someone's coming in, could you close the back door? Thank you. And So, good morning, everyone. This morning, I want to talk on the theme, things are not as they appear. So we'll see what that means. We'll see what it appears to mean. And whether the way it appears is the way I was meaning it to appear. Anyway, I guess I'm inviting a little playfulness with the theme. But it's a powerful theme, and it's one of the ways that I wanted to share from just having come back from being on retreat for 4 weeks. You know, as I mentioned at the beginning, and this is my first public appearance after 4 weeks of silence and relative seclusion, and I'm, you know, it's always a little bit of an unknown how the cognitive apparatus and so forth and speaking will work. But as I said, seems to be going okay so far. And so retreats are just so wonderful when, especially after the first or second, as ways to investigate deeply. And I love the process. And in fact, I'm in my own mind, I'm actually still on retreat because I'm doing a retreat next week, a week-long retreat, and I'm kind of holding the retreat that I was just in during this week. So I'm following the same schedule, which is more or less getting up at 5 and going to sleep about 10. And doing a lot of the same practices, a little bit less out in the world, not so much listening to the news shows I listen to, like Democracy Now! And so forth. And the, you know, the retreat, how many of you have done at least a few-day retreat at Spirit Rock or elsewhere? So most of you are familiar with this, but it's wonderful. Has aspects that are like a vacation where I don't have to deal with things, you know, don't have to take care of details or answer emails, and such a relief just to like be spontaneous, see what happens. Wonderful to do that for 4 weeks, to have people cook for me. Quite nice. Good food. And to you know, just have basically in the Buddhist tradition, there are these requisites that are needed for practice, which are basically shelter, food, and medicine. And those were all in place and got really to investigate. And it's really a privilege to do this. And, you know, one person I was talking to at the end of the retreat said, you know, amazing that this opportunity exists, which didn't exist in a very widespread way 50 years ago. People couldn't really do that easily. So very precious. And I'll just mention briefly some of the practices, because the theme that I'm going to explore today is related to some of what I was exploring on the retreat. But I was doing a few different kinds of practices. One of them was a form of loving kindness, which we call radiating metta. Some of you know, maybe I should teach it here another time, which is some people think is closest to the way that the Buddha taught loving kindness, which is basically that one develops concentration in the heart area around a sense of warmth and kindness, friendliness, have that established with concentration, and then you let it radiate out in all directions. Simple in concept, not always easy in practice. But I was doing that practice about 7 or 8 times a day for 15 to 40 minutes at a time. And I did it for all the meals, which is a really nice way to have silent meals in the dining hall. So I'd sit there doing my radiating metta. I would, you know, ground in the metta. I'd have my meal. Then I'd open my eyes, choose one person in the hall, you know, kind of get an image of that person, close my eyes, keep chewing, and radiate metta to that person. Then I'd, you know, go through you know, a short sequence with that person. Then I'd open my eyes, find another person. I had to sit in a place where I could see a lot of people and would would do that for 30 or 40 minutes, three times a day, and then also did it in the meditation. So it's quite a simple practice. Maybe I'll come back to that because it's a wonderful practice for daily life. When you get good at that practice, you can do it at meetings, public transportation, all sorts of things. You know, if you're in a helping profession or working with people, you can do it in those settings as well. So that was a practice. And then continuing to develop basically a clear mind without reactivity for extended periods, just to really have this settled, aware, open awareness. There were different techniques I used that I won't go into, but some version of that, which is sort of a further extension of our basic mindfulness practice. And I also did some extended practices with dream and sleep, with dreams and sleep, trying to bring awareness into dreams and sleeping, including deep sleep, which is... Those can be challenging practices, right? But to develop more lucid dreaming and so forth. Anyone explored that? Some of you have, so it's quite interesting. And that's some of the practices I did. And again, in retreats, as many of you know, there are different dimensions. There's a personal dimension where when the mind gets more quiet and settled, some of one's own questions about one's own personal journey, some of the larger choices in one's life, some of that starts to get clear when the mind settles. And it's one of the wonderful aspects of retreats that I really felt it was helping me to understand. I feel personally like it's a kind of transitional time. And how many of you are in transitional times? Many of us. Okay. It looks like about a third of the group, right? And so the retreats are very helpful for having just a sense as things settle, okay, what are the deeper motivations or aspirations on a personal level and then also on a more universal level? They're both of those dimensions are there in our journeys. And so I wanted to talk the rest of the time, and I think I'll talk next time as well when I come back in 2 weeks, on this theme of things are not as they appear. And I'm going to give you some practices to do in the next 2 weeks, if you so choose, that will help you to explore that topic. That theme of things not being as they appear is a very, very ancient theme, and it's very, very much... present in the core teachings from the Buddha as well as many other traditions. And there, you know, the one horizon for our practice is to transform delusion into wisdom. That's one of the fundamental ways we see it. So pointing out how there is delusion is quite important. So here are just a few passages that sort of bring that out. These are from the Buddha. Delusion burns the bewildered. Unaware of the noble Dhamma, unaware of the fires of suffering, they delight in self-identification. Another quotation, warped perceptions are what keep your mind on fire. Watch out for those warped perceptions. So we'll get right into those in a moment. We'll be exploring warped perceptions. I don't know what the original language word is for warped, but I like the translation. So, and then, you know, many of you us know that in the teachings of the Buddha, probably the most detailed teaching about the roots of suffering is the teaching that supposedly came to him on the night of his awakening, which is the teaching called dependent origination or dependent arising. I won't go into it so much to say, but it's a analysis of 12 factors interdependent that lead to suffering. And the first factor and the starting point is ignorance, some way that we don't see clearly, avidya. We don't notice clearly. And in the Tibetan tradition, some of you probably have seen, there's the wheel of dependent origination, which has 12 factors. How many of you have seen that image in the Tibetan tradition? A lot of you. And so the image for ignorance is that of a blind old woman being led by a boy. It's a way that we don't see clearly. And it's, again, it's an ignorance about the most basic nature of things. It's not an ignorance of facts or information. It's an ignorance about the nature of things, our own deeper nature, and the nature of phenomena. This is from Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Famous spiritual text. This is the dialogue. Martha, you know, some of you probably have seen the play. There was a movie of it too, wasn't there? Yeah. And it involves especially this difficult relation between Martha and George, right? So here's part of the dialogue. Martha, truth or illusion? George, you don't know the difference. George, no, I don't. But we must carry on as though we did. Martha, amen. So there's in a lot of the Buddhist and again other traditions, there is a pointing to the way that in some ways our waking life could be seen to be a dream. Some of you know this. You know, even the core metaphor used by the Buddha, even his very name, his term referring to him, is what? It's I am awake. To be the root for Bud has to do with being awake. So it juxtaposes being awake to being asleep and dreaming. It's a very common metaphor. This is from the Chinese tradition, Chuangzi. This is from what? About over 2,000 years ago. Some of you probably know this. Once Chuang Chu dreamt he was a butterfly flitting and fluttering around, happy with himself and doing as he pleased. He didn't know that he was Chuang Chu. Suddenly he woke up, and there he was, solid and unmistakable Chuang Chu. But he didn't know if he was Chuang Chu who had dreamt he was a butterfly, or a butterfly dreaming he was Chuang Chu. And then earlier, the text, it says, someday there will be a great awakening when we know that this is all a great dream, yet the stupid believe that they are awake. So there's this metaphor of waking life being more dream-like than we think, right? Again, it's not necessarily saying, I mean, some would say waking life is a dream. Others would say it's dreamlike. This is from the Tibetan tradition, using the metaphor of the dream as a way to look at the whole of life and the spiritual journey. This is the Buddha speaking. My dreamlike form appeared to dreamlike beings to show them the dreamlike path that leads to dreamlike enlightenment. How's that sound? And so the Buddha said, we are not awake. We're not seeing things clearly. You know, and in other traditions, again, many metaphors for not quite seeing that. It's said that our waking life is like an illusion, or it's like being in a dream, where it's like the reflection of a mirror. These are actually from a Tibetan text from the 19th century from a teacher named Dujon Lingpa, that our life is like an echo, not really out there, like the reflection of planets and stars in the ocean, like bubbles on water, like the optical illusion that occurs when we press the eye. And yet in our ordinary lives, we take things for granted and we think that we're seeing reality, don't we? You know, we think that we're just going about seeing a solid, permanent reality. And there's a way that our minds and our brains predispose us to that. You know, and I'll mention in a moment, some of the research from the neurosciences really can help point that out. So the philosopher Kant, for example, the German philosopher Kant from the 18th century, he said that we only can have experience because we, in a way, project onto the world that there is that things are substantial and inherent, that there is cause and effect, that there is actual existence of things. He actually said we can't actually know that that's true, but he said that experience isn't coherent unless we think that things are really out there in a way solid, permanent, and so forth. And when we look carefully, we know that children and babies have to learn to navigate the world, right? I don't know if your little one, where your little one is at with this, but it's interesting to look at it, right? No object permanence, yeah. And the psychologist William James said that for children up to a certain age, everything is a buzzing, booming confusion, right? And that we don't actually form solidity and permanence of objects up to a certain point. Language plays a very large role in this, doesn't it? That with language, at least Western languages, I don't know if all languages do this, but Western languages, we actually tend to think that things are solid. We say tree as if there was just something there that lasts. We don't say, this ever-changing object which we call a tree. We just say tree, and there's some implication of substance, coherence, and so forth. I remember that when I was a kid, I would think I was fascinated by this, and we'd be on a trip or something, and I'd ask my parents, what time is it? And they would say, 11:30, and I would say, whoops, not anymore. It's 11:31. Not anymore. And how far are we away from getting where we're going? We're 23 miles away. Not anymore. So I had some sense that the concepts were pragmatic, right? That they weren't fully accurate and things were changing. It was interesting. It was an interesting intuition as a child into some of that phenomena. But there are ways that our language makes things seem more solid than they actually are. This is from the philosopher Nietzsche, talking about how we form the world. A nerve stimulus transposed into an image. First metaphor. The image in turn imitated by a sound. Second metaphor. We believe we know something of the things themselves when we speak of trees, colors, snow, and flowers, but we possess only metaphors of things that do not in the slightest correspond to the original and essential entities. So there's something about language which makes things more solid. It's one of the reasons why when we meditate and move outside of a conceptual mind, we sometimes see things to be less solid. When the mind gets very quiet, sometimes we see the way that things are shimmering some, the way that our minds are in a way forming more solidity than there actually is. And part of this is because the brain really likes solidity and things to be kind of clear, right? It likes to use these concepts. Human beings, it's said, are one of the few species which have the ability to have what's called invariant visual object recognition. That means that we think things are actually not changing. Other species don't necessarily do that. It's interesting. And so it's based, the mind works with similarity and memory, and it says this is the same. Even though when we look closely, it might not be, right? But the mind likes to do that because it helps it move around the world. And language helps like that. And so in meditation, when we move outside of that more conventional mind, I'll get to that in a moment, we can see things differently, which is interesting. And we see that things are less solid than we actually think they are. So what I want to talk about are four ways that things are not as they appear. And I'll probably talk just about the first two today and then some of the others next time. But I'll mention the four then. I'm going to start with the one which is easiest to see, easiest to understand, and then move towards ones which are a little more subtle. Okay? So the first one is, we see everything through the lens of self in a distorted way. Okay? We see through the lens of self. So I'll come back to that. That's the first one. Second one is, we see permanence and solidity where there actually is impermanence and a lack of solidity. And I think those first two are what I'll explore today. The third, we see distinct, separate, individual things and beings where there is actually interdependence. And the last one, we see a separation between oneself and everything else, other selves and other beings, where there is ultimately non-separation. So if we explore these can be challenging for us. And I'll come back that when we explore this kind of territory, it's actually very helpful not to go too quickly and to hold everything with compassion. Because the fact that we don't see things clearly leads us, of course, the reason for seeing things clearly is not to suffer, and it's to find freedom. And it's saying when we don't see things clearly, we tend towards suffering. There's a passage from Shantideva from the 8th century, which I like to give, which says, this world is disturbed with insanity due to the exertions of those who are confused about themselves. So that does apply to social political analysis. Okay. But there's something about this whole intention to see clearly. So let's start with the first one, which again I think is probably most accessible. We see through the lens of self in a way that is often distorted. And there's a famous phrase that some of you probably have heard. We don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. Have you heard that one? Right? And people don't know quite where it came from. It's attributed probably very loosely to the Talmud. And it appears in a novel by Anais Nin. But it's an interesting phrase that is basically meaning we tend to see what we want to see. And we don't see what we don't want to see. Or sometimes, for example, if I'm very self-critical, I will tend to, let's say I'm giving a talk, and I tend to be really self-critical, and I get feedback about the talk, and 20 people say it was really good, and 3 people say, don't know about it, and make some critical comments, I will seize on those 3 and just fixate on that and think that's the reality, right? That's very familiar, isn't it? I remember when I was once co-organizing a summer institute for the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. And we had about 100 people. It was like 5 or 6 days. And about midway through, we did a survey, like just to see how things were going. And all of the organizers, I think we had like, you know, almost entirely positive responses, and 3 people had negative responses. And all of the organizers just went right to the negative and fixated on them, right? So we're familiar with that, you know. Can people here think of ways that you actually distort your perception based on either what you want or you don't want? Can you give a real-life example? Do we have the microphone handy for that? Okay. Yeah, so think of, we'll take a few examples of a real-life situation and see if you can have it be relatively brief, where we, you know, maybe where we see something through the lens of self in a way which is distorted. Okay, please.
Hi, I'm a retired attorney. So one of the one of the things that we learned was how when you have a witness, how they will react differently. So if you get 5 people in a room that have all seen exactly the same thing, one person will say, "Oh, he's wearing a blue shirt. Oh, he's smoking a pipe. Oh, he's short hair, long hair, glasses." You get so many different descriptions, colors included, and specifics, facial specifics that you would think everyone would have noticed or would at least agree on. So that's like an experience that I've had in my life.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
To show me that nobody sees the same thing.
People don't see the same thing. I think when they've done studies of memory, generally for relatively neutral things, but going back in memory, what they find is that people have generally not always such good, and there's a lot of individual difference, not such good memory for details, but people remember the gist, sort of the meaning. People have generally good recall of the gist or the meaning, but not so good for the, this is where it's not necessarily charged or anything, you know. But they don't necessarily have good memory for the details. But this was where people just don't see the same things. Yeah.
There was no time in between. There wasn't like 10 minutes or something. They just immediately had to describe what they saw.
Yeah.
It was so different.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, wherever there's something like fear or anxiety, people will see all sorts of things, right? You know, there's maybe, do you remember the description of the police officer who shot Michael Brown? Was in Ferguson, I think, right? Remember he said, I looked it up, he said, you know, for this police officer, the only way I can describe it, that he looked like a demon, right? Those were his words in testimony, right? He saw a demon. He didn't see a human being, right? Because of fear, you know, and maybe other things as well, maybe racism and so forth. But other examples of not seeing clearly, please, yeah.
I gave I was my brother's best man at the wedding.
Yeah.
So I got up and gave my speech, and everybody thought it was so funny. And then this one guy came up and said, "Boy, you really gave it to your brother. What a jerk." And all this stuff. And everybody said it was good, and I fixated on, like you said, what he said, right?
Yeah.
And then I still think about it today.
Yeah.
But a year later, I get an email from him saying that was one of the best speeches. Can you send it to me? Because now I have to give my
own.
That's great. I still hear that I was a jerk to my brother, you know, and that wasn't the intention.
That's right, yeah.
But even if once I got the email from him saying that was so good,
yeah,
can I borrow it, I still hear that I was a jerk.
That's right. And you know, we can really see how our wanting, our not wanting, our own wounds, our insecurities, our anxieties, maybe background of trauma, will make us see things in a way that aren't very accurate, right? That's pretty familiar. And maybe one or two more examples. Anyone else like to give an example? Please, we'll wait for the mic.
So this is sort of the classic mean girls, you know, high school experience.
Yeah.
As typical, what I would call myself a nerd and, you know, student, good student, played the piano, you know. And there were the girls who were, you know, really hip, and they had great hair and wonderful bodies, and they were very popular with the boys. And there was this one girl in particular, I was just so envious of how easy her life looked because she was part of this, you know, the cool girls. 30 years later, I just randomly bump into this woman.
Yeah.
And we started to talk, and she said, I was so envious of you in high school because you were such a good student, and you make it look so, you know, you were so successful. It was so easy, and I just thought I was stupid, and I was really struggling the whole time. And it was just this marvelous little gift that we could share with each other our, you know, typical misperceptions.
It was quite something. Cause we have, like, you could imagine the two sort of diametrically opposed groups, and everyone in one group is wanting what the other have, right? And they're, yeah. So, again, it's familiar how we tend to distort things out of wanting, not wanting. We know the concept of projection, where we project onto others sometimes what we either don't see in ourselves or what we want. A large amount of romantic life is based on projection, right? Right, and there's the so-called honeymoon period, and then, you know, people get married, and then there's always, you know, when they discover that the projections are not quite accurate, usually comes out like after 6 months. Right, and things shift a little bit, right? And people have to go through that period. Maybe one more example? Anyone like to give one more? Of how when things come through your own personal lens, things get distorted? Okay. That's okay. So I'll give just a few other examples. One of the examples is I've mentioned from time to time that I once worked in the U.S. Congress. When I was a student in college, I was like 18 years old. And it was a disillusioning experience for me because what I found was that the Congress people were so fixated on re-election and doing what was politically proper that they didn't look at the issues at all. And they, you know, everything was so, and I think it's gotten way worse now, right? But that was my sense of things as an 18-year-old, that the actual, there were people who really knew what the core problems were, you know, let's say it was transportation or gun violence or whatever. And these were the people who ran the congressional staffs. They read stuff, they knew what to do, but a large percentage of what needed to be done was not politically feasible. And everything came through people's positions, programs, ideologies. And, you know, and it's almost like they're creating like an alternative reality in which they did not see things clearly. That was my sense. You know, and you can even see that in the way that in contemporary political discourse, people use key words and they're different on the different sides. So they're almost like seeing a different world, right? Like people use what these days it's, I mean, I read a little bit of what's been happening since the retreat. Like people use the word, what, chain migration, right? And that's a politically loaded term. And what's the non, what's the term that the other side would, family reunification, right? Right, and you have all sorts of things. You have what, the death tax, right? And then you have other terms. I remember reading the linguist, George Lakoff, wrote a whole book about this. He talked about how framing makes all the difference, right? How you frame things, people see different worlds, right? So my suggestion for this first area of practice is to just study in your own experience when you notice phenomena like distortions because of your own preferences, reactivity, wanting, not wanting. Notice how that comes in. Notice how it influences your speech. Okay, so that's the first assignment if you choose to accept it. Okay, I hope you do. So to really, and because we'll come back and compare notes, which is fun. So really look at how your own likes, dislikes, wants, insecurities, securities, and so forth shifts perception. Okay, is that clear enough? And take notes. See how you do that. Okay, and we'll share that. The second area that I wanted to look at, and this will be the, and then I'll look at the other ones in 2 weeks, is how we take, this is getting a little more subtle, how we see permanence and solidity where there isn't permanence and solidity. Including we may think that we're permanent. You know, it's like when I sometimes ask for a show of hands, how many people think they will die? And half the people raise their hands. So what's that about? Right. There's some lack of full admittance of that truth, right? And so there are ways that we tend to see permanence and solidity. And so one way of working with it as a practice is just to reflect on a more gross level of impermanence, you know, where we just reflect on how things are changing in a very normal way, everyday way, how the seasons are changing, how, you know, movie stars come and go, politicians come and go, everything comes and goes, not bad or good, it's just what happens, that everything is changing, you know, empires come and go, and so forth. Things come, they stay for a while, then they leave. And one of the things that as we meditate, we can also start to see the change on a more subtle level. And this would connect back with what I was saying earlier, that there's a way in which when we live almost totally in a conceptual world, in a world mediated by thoughts, concepts, plans, which again is not in itself a problem. But when we do that exclusively, we don't have access to what is outside of a conceptually mediated world. And in meditation, we do. In meditation, we develop the capacity to be there with phenomena, with our awareness, when the mind becomes very quiet. And again, this happens naturally to us. Sometimes when the mind's very quiet, we're with a sunset or we're in nature. We see things a little differently, right? Or we're with music and we really just tune into the music. So this is very, very possible. And especially you find that the concepts are particularly connected with vision, right? Our conceptual life is very connected with vision. It's not so much there for sound or smell, taste, sensation. It's interesting, right? That the, you know, the language is pretty much designed to help us manipulate the world, which we especially do through vision. Does that make sense? Yeah, and it's interesting because when we actually explore other senses, it's less conceptually bound because we don't have, you know, we don't have a lot of concepts associated like with the variety of body sensations. You know, we can have a few words like sensation or warm, cold, sharp, whatever, but not much, you know, not like when we look outwardly. And so one of the practices that we can do is very simple. It's just watching change occur. Watching change occur with our breath, noticing the breath moving, noticing the in-breath arrive, stay for a while, and then end, then the out-breath. And again, it's not supposed to be particularly dramatic, but one of the practices we can do is to really study in our meditation things changing. Again, not meant to be dramatic or powerful necessarily, very ordinary in a way. But when we do this in a sustained way, we start tuning in to how things change. And again, part of this is also when the mind gets more quiet, when the mind's more concentrated, we can notice the changes and things start to be actually a little more flickering. There's a very interesting phenomena which has been studied by psychologists, which is called flicker fusion. Has anyone studied that? It's very interesting that our minds basically put things together so that they appear to be continuous and solid. Right? Again, I mentioned that not all species do that. Right? And we do this. The psychologists call this flicker fusion, that things are actually more fleeting and flickering. This is what we tune into in meditation. When the mind gets really quiet, things start to flicker and actually appear shimmering. And again, when the mind gets quiet in a natural way, like with beauty or with sometimes when one's in love, the mind just stops. Right? You know, feel that. And something, and the world can appear differently. Because how many of you have had experiences where the mind sort of stops and the world starts to shine some? Many of you see. So this is right. This is common, and this is what starts to appear when the mind gets more quiet, and we start to see a shimmering, shining, less solid way that things are. And so, the phenomena of flicker fusion is where things are actually flickering, but we sort of stitch them together in our minds. And some people think that this is because of it's particularly connected with vision, that it's connected with a phenomenon that's studied called the persistence of vision, where actually the image of an object stays on the retina for a fifth of a second after we actually see it. So it persists, and the mind sort of puts things together, much like we do with a movie, you know? 24 frames a second gives us the sense of solidity, right? If you do it in slow motion, you'll see the frame, one frame, one frame, one frame. If you get it going fast enough, it looks like everything's solid, right? And our minds are like that as well. We're doing that. And there's something interesting. It's very interesting that we don't see things clearly because of that kind of fusion. And it's very interesting to look at the word confusion. That because of that fusion, we have a confusion. Interesting, isn't it? That we're not really seeing things so accurately. Now, as that goes more deeply, it actually can be sometimes a little bit destabilizing when you start seeing that the world is less solid than you used to think. And so if you go deeply into it, it's important to work with a teacher. And to also, connected with this, is to have compassion for oneself and for others. As one starts to see that the world is less solid than we think, it's very important to bring in compassion. So practices to work with this. You can do the practice on gross impermanence just to reflect for 5 minutes on all the things which are changing at a more gross level. You know, I'm getting older, this is happening, you know, the seasons are changing, you know, the success of my favorite sports team arises and falls, you know, and so forth. And just to reflect whatever comes to mind. That's a way to practice to be more sensitive to impermanence. And then the other way would be to actually tune in to impermanence in your meditation or when your mind is quiet. And notice, and it's helpful to take one sense at a time. So right now, listen for sound. Listen for a sound arising, staying for a while, and then leaving. Any sound in the room? So as part of your meditation, you can actually just sit there, do your practice for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, tune into sound, whatever is there, you know. Maybe if there's not so much sound happening, do it in a public space, maybe where there are cars or something, but just somewhere noticing sounds arising. And that's a training in noticing impermanence that will open up as you deepen to that sense of things not being quite as solid. And you can do that with any of the senses. You can do that with taste when you're eating a meal. You can simply be with the changing taste. Watch how they come, stay for a while, change, pass away, right? You can do that with taste, smell. You can sit there and do that with body sensations. You can do it with thoughts. It's a little more subtle. You can sit there and just watch thoughts come, stay for a while, leave, right? You can do that. So I would suggest just doing it in the way that works best for you. Sound and sensations and taste are probably the easiest. And so you can work with that. So if you want to take that on, it's just to explore impermanence in that way. So my encouragement is to do these two forms of practice that start exploring two ways in which things aren't exactly as they appear. One, in the way that we bring our preferences, likes, dislikes, anxieties into things in ways that distort them. Study that in yourself, sometimes after the fact. And secondly, look into the nature of things appearing to be solid and impermanent by studying the process of impermanence. Okay? And we'll look at the other two ways that this manifests. One of them in the way that we, let's see what the other two were, that we see things as being separate and individual when they're actually interdependent. And the last one is that we tend to think I'm here and everything else is there when there actually is not an absolute separation. Okay? So I'll finish just with a short quote. And again, remember holding all of this with care, that people and ourselves not seeing things as they are does lead to suffering. You know, we don't always see it, but it does. And so some care and compassion is important. So this is from a Tibetan teacher named Dujom Rinpoche. Very short quotation. Having purified the great delusion, the heart's darkness, the radiant light of the unobscured sun continually rises. That's what we're pointing to. So it's that radiant sun of wisdom and the kind heart. So how many of you would like to do those practices in the next 2 weeks and come back? Okay, so you have to remember to do them, put it on your refrigerator, okay? But they're wonderful, simple practices and can really be part of some very powerful learning. And we'll keep it going. So we have about a little over 10 minutes if anyone has any questions, reflections, comments of any kind, more stories. Yeah, and we'll use the mics, so wait till they come to you.
I was just reflecting that with vision.
Yeah.
Because we have eyelids.
Yeah.
We can choose to not see.
Yeah.
As opposed to all the other sensations, sense awarenesses, where we don't have lids or the ability easily to stop the sensation.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting that we bewilder and confuse ourselves so well with our eyes?
Yeah. So we can close our eyes, or we can put things in our ears, but we don't usually carry around things in our pockets to use in the day. Yeah. So, I mean, that's interesting. Yeah, it's like the eyelids there, especially for sleeping? I don't know. What would biologists say? I don't know. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. I've just started reading a book, and I'm wondering if you've read it, called The Righteous Mind.
The Righteous Mind? I don't think so.
I think you would find it really interesting. I've just started it. I'm just that far into it, so I can't say anything very erudite about it.
Yeah.
But it really ties into everything you're talking about from a scientific point of view and psychological moral judgments.
Yeah.
Of how we come to make moral judgments and how we judge each other based on illusion, mostly.
Yeah, a lot. And sometimes we see things, but just in seeing what the basis is, particularly where we get really charged. You know, for me, it's I'm kind of a basketball fan. You know, like I follow the Warriors and so forth, and a lot of this, it's interesting to look at players' reactions to fouls called. Was that a foul? Was that intentional? Like people just get into very diametrically opposed views, very strong views. You know, based on what? Yeah. So, The Righteous Mind, do you know the author? Yeah. How do you spell it?
I think it's H-A-I-G-H-T.
Someone named Hate, perhaps. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. But it's a fascinating area when you look at it. Again, sports gives a very good example. One of the examples I remembered that I tried to look it up. I couldn't find it, you know, but I remember it. There was a very classic study like from, 1940s or 50s about a college football game after which there was kind of a riot. And someone studied the perceptions. The fans were basically on opposite sides of the field. And they studied the perceptions of the fans on both sides. And they found that on virtually everything significant, every significant detail, they had diametrically opposed views of reality about supposedly the same thing, you know. It was very interesting. It was like a very classic study of, and it was also like a group mentality as well. Yeah. Please.
excuse me. Before I started on this journey with mindfulness, I used to spend a lot of time in my mind. I'm just constantly in things churning and going, and I really took them to be truth, especially for myself, but just period, really. And since I started this mindfulness and this and sort of embracing this idea of impermanence, I noticed, this is the actual thing. Well, I was in the grocery store the other day, a couple of weeks ago, and I walked up and there was a chocolate bar. And it was one of those really good cocoa, 85% super, And I looked at the thing and I said, boy, I want that. And then I thought to myself, because I had just, I had actually been here with Sylvia earlier. And anyway, I decided just to stand there and just wait.
Yeah.
And I had this wanting, and it was a mind, my mind was saying you want. And I watched it dissolve.
Yeah.
I watched the whole thing go away.
Yeah.
And it was like, and I it was very, it was profound.
Yeah.
I mean, just seeing that impermanence, that thought was just for a time, a moment, and then it dissolved. Anyway, that was
beautiful practice, and that could be something interesting to do, because we can see how wanting or not wanting can shift our perception, but actually to stay with and be mindful, and because in the mind, when we have a very strong wanting or not wanting, it feels really solid, right? It's another example of this. It feels solid. You know, it's like something in the brain is saying, urgent, alert, respond immediately, right? And when we actually can be mindful, we can actually sometimes watch it fade. And what we do could be one way or the other, but actually to not be under the grip so much of that wanting or not wanting, it is powerful practice. Yeah, very freeing. And I remember, it makes me think that I've mentioned probably from time to time that quite a while ago I co-taught a class with Diana Winston on greed management. And, you know, we had very, very low enrollment. And and our final exam was to do silent walking meditation in a newly opened Bed Bath and Beyond. And people got to watch that. People got to watch. I discovered that I was wanting things that half an hour before I didn't even know existed for needs that I didn't know existed, right? You know, like the one I remember was like something that you put on top of a television set that gives more storage space. I said, oh my God, great idea. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Sometimes we point to the fact that the aim of our practice is to see things as clearly as possible, right? And to see where we project, and that's a lot of what the invitation is for the next 2 weeks, to see where we project, where we impose because of our wants and what we don't want, where we impose that onto reality, where we interpret people in certain ways, interpret situations in certain ways, and to really study that. Again, we want to be careful of any tendencies to use that as a basis for being judgmental. Okay? I don't think I said that clearly before, that there's something about looking into this area which could, if we have a tendency to be judgmental, something like this study could activate that. You know, it's what I find in, you know, in teaching a lot on the judgmental mind. I have to always give the initial instruction, when you're noticing a lot of judgments, notice the judgment, there are a lot of judgments, and don't get hooked by it, right? Same thing here. If you notice yourself distorting, it could be a basis for becoming hard on oneself, but we're really trying to look carefully at things. So if you have any tendency to that, then it's helpful to really spend some time also with loving kindness or compassion practice, just a little bit to help balance the process of sort of seeing through places where we're not seeing clearly, where we're projecting, and some of it's connected more obviously with suffering. Okay, well let's finish, and let's come back to set your intention for the next 2 weeks. I hope that we can really follow this practice. For those who are relatively new here, the recording of this morning will be on the website dharmaseed.org, and you could listen to this. Hopefully be up by later today or tomorrow. And there's no cost, right? dharmaseed.org. And look under teachers. Actually, it'll be listed right as a most recent talk. It'll be right there. But if you can also go to my name, Donald Rothberg, under teachers, and you'll find it right there. So just reflect on how you would like to, if you so choose, to continue this exploration, both in the flow of everyday life and in more formal meditation. Just take a moment and set your intentions. Let me close, as we typically do, by remembering that we do this practice very much for ourselves, our own well-being, but also we do it for others, those in our own circles, and ultimately our practice has potential to extend to all beings. And so we offer the benefits of our mourning and our practice to others, ultimately to all others. Thank you, and to be continued. Okay, till next time.